But every piece of money that transfers, and I mean, you're talking drug money, so you're talking hundreds of thousands, millions probably, the Hawaladars get 10%. So that's a lot of money when it comes to drug money. And that money is going from Iran directly to Hezbollah to fund them. And that's the big problem.
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you're listening to Crime World, a podcast about criminals, drugs, and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe.
A tiny Iranian island known as the Pearl of the Persian Gulf has been identified as a hub for Kinahan dirty money, and is where America's Drug Enforcement Agency believe that their drug funds made their way into the hands of Hezbollah. Kish Island is part of Iran, but it's also a free trade zone with lax banking practices, making it attractive to the top end of organised crime. Kish Island is part of Iran, but it's also a free trade zone with lax banking practices, making it attractive to the top end of organised crime. Today, I'm talking with Niall Donald about Kish and its links to the Kinahan organisation. And we discuss the changing face of Daniel Kinahan, from Oliver Bond's schoolboy to international drug don with a hankering for home. This is Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. This business with Iran and the Kinahans and all the rest of it, they have been in and out of Iran in the past, but my understanding is that they have remained in Dubai since the sanctions of April 2022.
Right.
And they haven't moved out of Dubai at all. They're still there. I know I've had many reports of people who have seen Daniel and describe him as looking absolutely wrecked, worse for wear, stressed out. They are all, the description that people have given me of them is that they're like literally on edge, constantly waiting for the knock on the door that could happen any morning. Some people will say, oh, they'll get the nod when they're going for them, the police in Dubai, which they probably will, given that we know the amount of influence they've had in the United Arab Emirates over the time. But they are not in Iran. They have not fled to Dubai, to Oman or to various other places. So many rumours have gone around about them. Some of them put out by themselves and some of them generally just sort of, I suppose, inform speculation as well as everything else. But they remain in Dubai, but Iran is very significant in the whole story.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like, obviously, the you can see what the attraction of Iran would be for the Kinahans. I mean, they literally...
What?
Well, I mean, they literally do not
talk... men, which helps.
Well, I wasn't even thinking in those terms. I was thinking in terms of what country is definitely not going to extradite you to the US.
Indeed.
And it really comes down to North Korea, Iran, and a couple of others.
Yeah. Like obviously Afghanistan.
Afghanistan. So like Iran.
So the choices are small.
Well, they are small, but I mean, like there certainly is never going to be any diplomatic engagement between those countries, you would imagine. I mean, obviously the Iranians and the Americans did talk at some point over in recent years, but at the moment that's just not going to happen. And you can see why that would be a place that they would have as a backup in mind, I suppose.
But what would life be like in Iran?
Well,
I mean, well, okay, we'll come on to this island that I was writing about at the weekend.
Which was actually really interesting, I thought.
The Pearl of the Persian Gulf.
Yeah.
Did you think that was interesting?
No, I actually read, I'd love to say I knew loads about Kish Island before you mentioned it, but it's actually... Like, you see, Iran...
The fact that we didn't know it exists is interesting. There's no doubt about it. Like, I mean, Iran has tourism. Can you believe that?
Well, I can, Nicola, because Iran, before the Iranian Revolution, like, you have to remember, Iran was like Thailand or something like that. It was on the hippie trail.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a totally different country before the Iranian Revolution. It's not...
What year was that? That was 1980. I'll look that up while you're talking.
So, I mean, like, Iran is not a sort of monolithical kind of, you know, country. Like, you know, there's a very young population. It's a very, quite a developed country and a lot of different things going on in Iran that we probably don't perceive in the Western media, you know. Like, so, I mean, obviously there is this place, Kish Island, it's called. What would you, did you describe it as? It's the Costa del Sol of the Persian Gulf or something like that.
It's the Costa del Sol. There's slightly more relaxed rules. Just before we forget there, I'll just tell you that the revolution was in 1979.
Well, you see, before the revolution, like Iran was a very kind of middle class liberal country in many ways, mm-hmm. very highly educated population. Still one of the youngest populations in the world in terms of people being under 25. You know, we have a very particular perception of it, which, you know, the Ayatollahs and this sort of thing. But like, it's probably not, it isn't that type of country en masse for sure. So
I don't know why, but like, so I was born in 1974. Mm. So I was five when that Iranian revolution happened. But as a child, the Ayatollah Khomeini was very much in my head.
Yeah.
He was very much, was it that the news was on? I don't know.
Totally. Like, I mean, if like he was the.
But I think we might have known Persians who had fled with their whatever they had left. I mean, of course, in more recent years and through our work, we know that the, you know, that revolution, the rise of Khomeini, and when people had to flee, they went with their. They couldn't take their money, wasn't that right?
Well, yeah, I mean, they nationalised all the oil and all of that. I mean, look, the Americans' role in Iran is not...
Scientists and everybody had to just literally up and leave.
So, I mean, the Americans didn't have a glorious role in all of that either. Mm. Like, but you have to, so I suppose, but this is geopolitical crime world. This is really...
this is too much.
But I suppose it is a different type of country really than maybe we perceived of it growing up. I mean, you know, there's huge like heavy metal scene and all of that. And there's obviously at the moment, there's huge social upheaval at the moment about from women within Iran and the role that that's being enforced on them as they perceive it, you know. So, but I don't think the Kilhins are picking
they're
Iran.
They're not interested in the history of it.
No. I think what they're looking at this place, Kish.
Yeah.
Which, when you look it up, it's a small island. I think it said it was a population of something like 50.
5,000.
Or 50. Was it not 50 or?
5.
Was it? So it's basically one of these free ports. Mm. What is it, 50,000?
No, it's between yours and mine.
30,000.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, look. What's a few thousand between
friends? No, there was
friends?
Something, no, because I did, I was actually, when I was writing it was something about, maybe there was 5,000, maybe it was a part of this particular area they were in Kish, but there was kind of like a full-time population of maybe 5, and then the rest of them are visitors.
Yeah, I think it said 1 million visitors a year or so. So it's really
you know,
million
figures anyway.
Yeah, so it's basically a kind of a, it's an area of the country, an island that's off the coast, and they allow these more relaxed rules, and they're trying to bring in, obviously, investment. Now, they're not going to get, American Intel and Facebook aren't going to land in Kish Island because there's huge sanctions against Iran still in the US. It would not be looked on kindly or at all possible. So instead, they're trying to attract other money. And in order to attract that money, they allow this place to exist, which is something like Dubai, where, you know, Western rules are going to be allowed. They're going to be allowed to sell alcohol, things along those lines. But what sort of money are
in
they going to get?
In particular, it's not that relaxed. And there's apparently the airport is absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
There's 4 terminals in it, even though it's such a tiny island with such a tiny population. And actually, it was in between yours and mine. The population is 25,000 residents and 1 million visitors is right. But yeah, 4 terminals. And women, when they come into the country, they are immediately taken and they're given clothing to wear when they're on the island, which is the full covering. And they are expected to wear that at all times when on the island.
Yeah.
And then they give it back when they go to the airport on the way. So you don't have to bring your own gear.
Right.
Which would be handy if you were coming from here for a holiday, because you wouldn't, where would you go to buy that stuff? And of course, you know, what sort of thread would you use in that heat?
Yeah. And of course, they whether they're even, whatever about the social aspect of it, like they certainly have liberal rules regarding investment and paying tax and all of those things.
It's
and
one of these free trade zones, which we first came upon, if you remember.
Yeah, I do.
Which was about 2016, I think. It was September of 2016 from memory.
Yeah.
And there had been a raid on the then named MGM gym in Marbella.
Yeah.
And the police had gone in I think James Quinn had been arrested in relation to the murder of Gary Hutch. He was later found guilty of that murder. But the gym in Portobenouse that I had visited back in 2012 was raided. And when we looked online for through the company records, you and I, we went through the stuff, we discovered that just weeks previous, the intellectual rights of MGM had been transferred to a place called Ra's Al Khaimah.
And basically a sort of post office box, effectively, in a Freeport, which, you know,
Ra's Al Khaimah, RAS, I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong. In actual fact, I did get an encrypted email from somebody very close to the Kinahan organization to tell me that I pronounced it wrong to shame me for that.
Right.
So I'll just do it as Ra's Al Khaimah. It's the largest city and capital of the Emirates. And it's the sixth largest city in the UAE. It is a free trade zone where you can register companies without ever giving any details. Exactly. So Kish is the same.
Well, Kish is the same, except for there's a layer of protection there that Dubai, as Dubai has, you know, certainly attracted a lot of dirty money as it started to flourish, not just from organized criminals in Ireland, obviously from all over Europe, and then a lot of from Eastern Europe political figures as well, from places like Russia. A lot of people flooded there because of the lax legislation around money laundering and various other things. But as Dubai has become more successful, they've tried to merge it back in again with the international community. And the international community, like the EU and the US, are making it clear, we're not going to allow this to be the Wild West. So Dubai have started to tighten up money laundering legislation, extraditing people, all of those things. Christy Kinahan and his sons must be sitting there and thinking, this could come for us, and where could we go next? And, you know, really, Iran probably is somewhere that they would look at and think, we're not going to be extradited from this place quickly or easily. There's effectively no diplomatic relations between those countries. There's no extradition treaty. Even if there was an extradition treaty, we'd be way down the list. Mm. So I think that's what they're looking at.
You think they'd see it as an option? Can I read you from The Lonely Planet?
You can.
Kish Island, welcome to Iran's Sunshine Coast. However you label it, say hello to this attractive island that since 1970s has become a beach resort where visitors can swim, shop and sample a laid-back and relatively liberated local lifestyle. Iran's most hedonistic spot, Kish, is booming. Hotels, apartment blocks and retail complexes, brackets, it enjoys free trade zone status, dominate the once empty desert landscape, and domestic tourist numbers are on the rise, especially in winter when it's freezing cold on the mainland. Kish is largely ignored by foreign tourists, though. That's a shame, because a visit here is a great way to experience Iran from an altogether different perspective. Leave the sight-laden cities of the mainland and come here to enjoy sea, sand and sun in a relaxed atmosphere.
There you go. Relaxed. No DEA agents.
No DEA. Well, funny enough, not funny enough, but an FBI agent went missing from the... from Kish Island some years ago. It remains an unsolved case.
Yeah.
I actually included that in the article. I'll pull that up now while you're...
Yeah. So, I mean, you can see what that attraction would be, because the net certainly is closing in on it. And, you know, we have had, some suggestions now, very strong suggestions, that part of why the Americans have taken such an interest in the Kinahan cartel have been their ties with Iran, and given the nature of the fact that Iran are regarded effectively as a terrorist state by the American government, that seems to have helped draw attention on the Kinahans, and certainly allowed the Gardaí to make a case that these weren't an ordinary, for want of a better word, drug smuggling cartel.
And we'll just explain that a bit. The FBI officer, it was Robert Levison. He disappeared in the mid-2000s from a hotel on that island after going to interview an American convert to Islam there. And his case remains unsolved. Now, the kind of the first links to between the Kinahans and Hezbollah, the terror group suspected of being funded by Iran, was when... In 2016, the Dutch criminal Nawaf Al Fassi was discovered in a safe house here in Dublin, Kinahan safe house. There was a raid and he was found. They didn't know who he was, sent his details through Interpol, and it turned out he was wanted in the Netherlands. Now, he was wanted in connection with a number of gangland murders in Holland, including that of a guy called Mohammed Samadi, who was an Iranian who had been sentenced to death by Tehran because he was accused of a 1980s bombing, which had killed 73 people. And he was living in the Netherlands under an assumed identity. But presumably the government of the Netherlands had allowed him to reside there, given him some sort of political status.
Yeah, I mean, what happened, I suppose, was the Iranian state, and this is partly why, you know, they were judged to be a terrorist organization, is that they did attempt to kill political dissidents outside of the country. Probably something similar to what the Russians have done. So they did arrange these hits, if possible. Obviously, in this case, they had connections with that broader organization, the Morocco Mafia, the Kenyan Cartel, the Super Cartel, effectively. Mm-hmm. And they hired a hitman, basically, to kill this guy.
Who was Fassi.
And who he was ultimately convicted of it, I believe.
And he was on the run here, you know, in relation to that. He was hiding out here in the Kinahan safe
house. And other offences as well. So, I mean, he is at the top of the absolute top of that organisation that is effectively run by Ridwan Taji. So it's a disturbing kind of, I think it was described as a nexus by former Assistant Commissioner John O'Driscoll. So, I mean,
he was talking about it all recently, so it's not just...
it's not just kind of speculation or off-the-record sources. So, I mean, what he's saying is it was a nexus between organised crime and terrorism, and that drew the American attention on it. Like, obviously, the other part of it is the money laundering.
The Hawala money laundering system, which is the ancient sort of... system that has been used by the Kinahan organization.
Yes, which is kind of based in that part of the world and involves kind of, I'm not even going to attempt to explain this because I always get it slightly wrong. But basically, you know, the assistant commissioner, former assistant commissioner has said is that the Kinahans, they identify places like Iran where these money transfers are possible, where they're not going to be traced, where they're not going to be subject to warrants. They're not going to be subject to you know, having to be handed over. And they're using it. I don't think anybody is suggesting that they are committed to Hezbollah or believe in their causes. But what they're really committed to is finding places, and they'll work with anybody to launder their money as long as it can be done beyond the reach of police forces.
And I suppose their money has become so vast that... So that Hawala system, which I'll explain to you again, but it's basically a system where I don't totally understand it myself, but there are these Hawala dars who are the sort of the banks in various regions of the world. And if you want to transfer money, there's this sort of credit and debit system.
Yeah.
And from my understanding of it, sort of the Iranian sort of government essentially would be a Hawala dar almost. You know what I mean? They're almost transferring. But every piece of money that transfers, and I mean, you're talking drug money, so you're talking hundreds of thousands, millions probably, the Hawaladars get 10%.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of money when it comes to drug money.
Yeah.
And that money is going from Iran directly to Hezbollah to fund them.
Yeah.
And that's the big problem.
And I mean, and what they're saying, the Gardaí effectively are, I think they described it as being reckless by the Kinahans, that they didn't care who they were getting involved with as long as they could make this money, clean this money. And it was described, as reckless. And but that has attracted the attention of the US government, who are very, who obviously have ties, very strong ties with the Israeli government. Hezbollah are regarded as being one of the primary threats to Israel.
I feel like we're in an episode of Homelands here, and I should be starting to stick things up all over
the
walls.
Do you know what these things are? Like, again, if somebody had said to you when we were writing, saying 10 years ago with Christy Kinnan inviting people to boxing matches, if I said, oh, they're all mixed up with Hezbollah and there's ties, it just sounded like wacky conspiracy theory. But this is what's unfolding.
I mean, I'm just sitting here thinking to myself, you know, isn't it a long way for Daniel and Christopher Kinahan Jr., from Oliver Bond to Kish Island in Iran, to the journey they have made over two and a half decades, has been quite extraordinary.
Incredible. Like, I mean, an incredible tale.
Nothing wrong with Oliver Bond.
No.
It's just where they grew up.
No.
It's like me saying it's a big journey from,
Drumcondra to... No, it's a massive...
But I mean, like, to go from that into that world of literally homelands.
Oh, yeah. To go from, like, you know... controlling
the cultural differences and everything that they have experienced and that they're operating in. And it just shows you how money can bring you anywhere, doesn't it?
Into does.
Any single culture, into any religious grouping. Doors open across the world when it comes to money.
And then it's starting to get narrower, you see. Mm. So they got really, really wide, and now it's starting to narrow in where they can't go to America, they can't move out of Dubai. They can't invest their money in loads of places in the world, and it's getting narrower and narrower.
Mm.
And they're down to maybe an island off the coast of Iran, for example, because the places that they could go to, you know, they were, you know, only 4 or 5 years or whatever, they could float around Ireland. Do you remember Daniel Kinahan coming back through Dublin Airport and being greeted by photographers? I mean, that's not so long ago, but the world... for all that it got so open and wide is now...
it's become so tiny for
them. It's become so tiny. Yeah. And the route to avoid ending up in prison has gotten really, really narrow.
And will become smaller, you know, as, you know, the weeks and months, if they have months left, who knows? You know, it will become smaller because the fact of the matter is that Daniel Kinahan is as likely to show up in the special criminal court here in Dublin as he is in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
You know, it's either the States or Ireland for him.
Yeah.
I think his father, Christy Kinahan Sr., given the massive investigation into money laundering in Spain, it's either Spain or the US for him.
Yeah.
And as regards Christy Kinahan Jr., nobody seems to really talk about him. He just, while he was... you know, on the money laundering end of his father's business. And do you remember in Operation Shovel in 2010, that sort of map they drew of the Kinahan organization? You had, at that point, you had Christy Kinahan Sr. at the top of it, along with John Cunningham.
Yeah.
Where the hell is John Cunningham?
I don't know.
Hidden out in Spain. If anybody knows, please get in contact, because I'd be very interested in tapping him up or knocking on his door. But you had the two of them.
Yeah.
And then underneath them, directly underneath them, you had... to the right was Daniel Kinahan in charge of what the Google Translate said was difficult decisions, i.e. murders.
Yeah, yeah.
And to the left was Christopher Kinahan Jr., who was money laundering with the help of others. And there was always this impression that did Kinahan Jr., was he there because of his name?
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
Or was he there because of his skills?
And he did seem to be do a good bit of travelling, you know, around to do some of these things face to face regarding the money.
What I find curious is, look, I know there's all this, you know, there's all these, this talk about MI5 and, you know, the Kinahans being informants, and the only reason they're left standing is because they're still of use. They're still handing up others, that they've handed up all the super cartel, that they knew that the DEA were watching the wedding that they've been in. We'll never know whether any of that is true, and nor will it ever be confirmed. Maybe when I'm in my 80s or something, somebody will come out as a whistleblower, and I'll be too old for anybody to be bothered listening to me. But what I always found curious was, I do know that Christopher Kinahan Jr. was moving in and out of London.
Yeah.
At a time, I mean, I'm talking about the last, you know, number of years, when I know for a fact that Daniel Kinahan wouldn't have left Dubai.
Yeah.
But he certainly was moving in and out of London. And you'd have to wonder, why would he take the risk at coming not only back into Europe, but right into the UK? I mean...
Well, was he... I mean, was it conceivable he was facing any charges, I suppose? So maybe the risk was not as...
For him?
Yeah.
But they were all still surely at risk. I mean, you didn't see Christopher Kinahan Sr. moving much. I mean, we don't know, was he moving around between China and, you know, wherever else he goes, but they weren't coming into Europe, any of them.
Yeah,
and
I mean, look,
Junior was, and certainly felt comfortable to do that. That's the only, I'm just saying, I mean, I don't know about any of this. Obviously, you know, rivals and criminal organizations will always say somebody's ratting, and that's
what they always like to say. And I mean, you'd have to ask, you know, if they got to the size they got to, like, who are they, you know, who are they you know...
They got to an enormous size and scale, and they did get away with an awful lot over the years. And, you know, are they that clever, or are they political? Have they been playing the game?
Well, I think if you look at... Well, I mean, I would put it down to cleverness myself, primarily, because if you look from where they came to where they ended up, and you see even these kind of the things about Christie Senior with his businesses and buying planes and all that, you just see somebody who's kind of operating a level ahead.
He's definitely always looking into the future. You can see that. I mean, in 2016, when the boys arrive in Dubai and they're kind of inner circle, largely from Dublin, and their childhood friends, some of them, he's already on his way to Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
He's on his way out of the Gulf. He's got sick of that. He's gone beyond it.
And if you look at say Taji, and you know, from what we know of his criminal organization, it seems to be really ruled by a kind of a fear, like he's going to kill everybody who gets in his way.
Yeah.
But Christie Senior is obviously operating at a sort of a more advanced level. He seems to have a knowledge of you know, politics and finance and things like that. So I'm always wary of people saying just because they got away with it, they're informers.
I know, because you have to be wary of it. Of course you have to be wary of it. But at the same time, I suppose, you know, sometimes when you dip into a little bit of what happened in the north, you see what's possible.
You do.
And you see how it's slightly ignorant to think that isn't possible.
No, and I mean, when it comes to things like terrorism, for example, you know, governments can behave in a very amoral way. And you see that with the US government and the UK government, where if they're getting information on terrorism, they will let other things slide.
Yeah.
And that they have operated like that. So there, it is conceivable, but I would be skeptical, I have to say, because of the size of the criminal organization that they operate.
And the level, you would like to think that the level of violence that, you know, they were perpetrating, that wouldn't be acceptable. But again, you know, we look to the north, we look to the US, we look to the sort of the corruption that has gone on between criminal organization, government, police systems. You have to keep an open mind, I think, is what I mean to say. You'd like to think in an ideal world, there's absolutely no way the Kinahans were working as informants or were allowed to get away with any of what they have got away with so far. But I think you probably have to just sort of...
Well, you can't. Yeah, you can't look. I mean, you have to look at, you know...
Or maybe I just need to...
if you're getting...
Take a break.
Well...
What do you think? Another Hollabops?
Sure, why not? Something go on your holidays. They'll probably be extradited then, because that'll be your...
Do you know what it is? The more time I have on my hands, it's actually, I'm better off kept busy, busy, busy. You know, when I'm like hyper busy, that I don't actually have time to think about and up these things.
Definitely. You need constant stimulation, Nicola.
That's the...
You can't be left to your own devices. You can't be left to your own devices.
Diagnose that?
No, not on air. But you need to be kept busy. That's what I'm
because
going
I've
to
actually
it.
Sort of, and I, as I said to you, I've been having great night sleeps, and I've been very good, and you know,
now
bed early and all that sort of stuff for the last while. But the brain is just going like 90 with all this sort of stuff. That when I start thinking about it, when I apply myself to it, a bit like that one in
Better
Homelands,
go back on
maybe.
Tour again.
You'll come in here now one day. Did you ever see Homelands?
I did. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Did you ever see that where he builds up his conspiracy theory?
She's sort of, I suppose, unwell like her disorders are kind of kicking in.
She's drawing
connections. You walk in and the entire room is just, you know, post-its.
Yes.
With connections and lines. And all. Yes. You'll come in here and it'll be like that. She'll go, she's... Or else the Indo Daily will come in and rip it all down.
Go on, just write another book, Nicola. Yeah, that's what you'll have to do.
Yeah. But yes, sorry, we have slightly gone off.
Yeah, no, but it is interesting that Kish is an interesting place, because I think you can see, you know, I remember actually saying, I think in this podcast, where are they going to go, Afghanistan and hide their money in a cave? But it's interesting to see somewhere like that you can see that they could live there.
Yeah.
You could see that
in the
standards
they're used to.
And you could see that it would be a livable circumstance, and you could see how they would, you know, they would at least be untouchable for the moment by the US government. And yeah, it's interesting.
But they're not there.
They're so not there.
They, if they could somehow manage to get well, there, I you think mean, they, over yeah, the next yeah, couple, I think they might looked, get another year or two.
Yeah, and I think they looked at places like Zimbabwe as well, which yeah. would kind of be regarded as a rogue state. I think they
well,
looked
Kinahan
at...
Well, Kinahan Sr. certainly looked at that, but there was no evidence that the Daniel...
No, but I think they must have been looking at these places around the world where it's kind of a fallback position.
I think Daniel Kinahan was, as an individual, was just feeling so untouchable. I mean, to think that... That you know, that famous interview that he gave to James English that we've never heard, which is so unfortunate. Yeah. I'd love to get my hands on that and have a listen to it. It was 2.5 or 3 hours.
Yeah.
I mean, at that point in time, that was the moment really that it all tipped for him, wasn't it?
Well, I think so. That was Paddy's Day, wasn't it? Yeah. It was due to come out, and obviously the sanctions came within weeks.
Yeah.
And at that point, definitely.
Probably the 4th of April were the sanctions, I think.
Well, so that's what it was. So yeah. I think at that point, he could see a future where. All he was really fighting against was
the media,
the Irish media,
yeah,
giving him a bit of a bad rep. And he was just going to have to fight an ongoing sort of battle against the Irish media, saying he was being slandered and he'd have other people backing him up. And really, he'd be able to continue on. Remember, we had constant things. Obviously, Bob Arum has changed his tune, but there was people like him. There was people from the head of boxing organizations speaking about how poor Daniel had been slandered and misrepresented. And, you know, they were coming out again and again, different promoters, different boxers. And he had an end game in mind, which was to have a publicity campaign to blacken the Irish media and say otherwise. And that is all obviously.
And he had, of course, very recent to that interview that he'd done, he had posed with the Pakistani sports minister.
Yeah.
Like, how does somebody like Daniel Kinahan go from street dealer to being in that position that he's posing and he's been welcomed by the Pakistani sports minister at a function and treated like he is a god almost?
Yeah. Like, I mean, it's an incredible achievement if you want to look at it that way. Like he must have a particular drive, ambition and capacity, I suppose. And again, I know did you give out to me about this last week? But he must have be a talented, very talented person.
I gave out to you about that for saying that about your man, Thomas Maher. Because you said he would have been a talented businessman because he drove trucks and stuff.
No, but I mean...
You were just being a bit too...
No, but I mean, I think, look, whatever about Thomas Maher, you couldn't deny it about Daniel Kinahan, that he must have a capacity to make people, you know, to draw people to him and all of that. But fortunately, it comes with a very dark... side
people were afraid though.
People were afraid. All of that.
I mean, people always talk. I have spoken to people who knew him when he was a young guy in Dublin here.
In his 20s, yeah.
And in his teen years as well. And they describe him as being good fun. They describe him as being, you know, a loyal friend, a nice guy, a really charming guy.
Yeah.
You know, he was quite a hit with the women.
Yeah.
He was somebody who never touched drugs himself. He'd always give it out for the others to try them, even if they had, you know, a new e-tab or something like that. He'd never take it himself. He looked after himself. He was close to his community.
Yeah.
And then I've spoken to people who knew him when he would have been first sort of coming of age in his father's organization and probably down around the Costa del Sol and in England. And they talk about this very dark character who sort of initially would come across as being the guy who'd pick up the bill in a restaurant, the guy who was trying to ingratiate himself really sound. You know, he'd come, oh, I'm Dan, how are you, buddy?
Yeah.
And all this sort of stuff. But was very quickly, and when he got you on his own, let you know who he is.
Yeah.
And there'd be some sort of a conversation that you'd be left standing going, did that just happen?
Yeah.
Where he would have warned you that, you know, the status he had and the status you had, which was very much beneath him.
Yeah.
He spoke to his father always on the phone, signing off with, love your dad.
Yeah.
And the father back to him. There was all this sort of kind of slightly sinister given what they did and what they were sort of think some of the things they were talking about between them would be, you know, massive drug shipments, murder.
Yeah.
And then at the end of it, signing off, love you.
Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt that the threat of violence was something that he used constantly. I remember even in that the race fixing trial, one of the witnesses given evidence saying about Daniel Kinnan, well, he was only a small little guy, but when he warned you, you knew you'd been warned.
Yeah.
That, you know, he had that absolute intimidating aura. And it wasn't just an aura, of course, because they did.
Oh, it was real.
There was the backup, the real backup of it.
And, you know, like people who would have known him and been in his circle as such, and maybe he would have put down, they were disappointed. They were gutted by that. They were upset. They were people who were really believed themselves to be his friend. And then just like that, he'd be able to just cut them down.
Yeah.
Which is maybe the way I would have always thought, maybe the way the father was able to operate. But, you know, as he went on, he obviously did still continue to be able to charm people, bring people into his inner circle. Yeah. He became darker and darker as time went on. He has very loyalists around him still. Bernard
Clancy,
who came with him from Dublin and was named in the US sanctions as being one of his right-hand men, and his cousin Ian Dixon as well.
Yeah.
He was one of the first out to Spain to the gym, the MGM gym, when it opened as a boxer. I think he was signed initially and then became a coach. There's others as well who have been with him since he was in Dublin who are utterly loyal to him.
Yeah.
But you'd wonder, are they, or are they just, have they no way out?
Yeah.
Have they no way to back away from him at all? I always thought that's what happened from speaking to sources within and close to the boxing, to the high end boxing who were engaged with him. It was like as if they were always dying for him to be arrested.
Yeah.
So as the nightmare would end. Like they'd no way out of it.
No, I mean, they did. Of course they had no way out. And you know, remember we talk about the deaths in the feud, the Hutch Kinahan feud, but there was many, many deaths of other people killed by the Kinahan cartel for minor fallouts, for minor amounts of money, and for suspicions of being, you know, a risk of informing or damaging the organisation.
Mm.
So, yeah, I mean, it's, look, there's no doubt he was as well, like, unlike a lot of people involved in drugs, like, his level of ambition is incredible, really, if you think about it. Because not only did he rise to the top of this criminal world and could have stayed there, maybe like some of his other contemporaries, like Rafael Imperiale, but he had a whole other ambition to become the head of the sport, an international sporting organization, and not just a silent power behind the throne, but to become kind of a personality as well, a public personality. I mean, it's an incredible level of ambition and drive.
Like, do you know, we speak about regularly the famous wedding in the Burj Al Arab, but when I look at that, and I don't know whether people quite understand what was going on there. So he was preparing for this wedding in a 7-star hotel. This was his moment to stand up and to show the criminal fraternity and the legitimate boxing world who he was, what he had become. And he was marrying a girl from Dublin, despite how far he'd gone to Kish Island, off Iran and everything. He always came back to Dublin for something close. So, you know, Kiva Robinson, who was an ex-partner, her previous partner, Micah Kelly, was murdered
by the real IRA.
And that she actually came out of her apartment and found his body on the road. She just had a baby for him. And Daniel Kinahan and herself began a relationship after that. Tragedy for her. But anyway, she was coming from Dublin out to Dubai to marry him. And, you know, there was going to be no budget limits and the meetings and the tastings and all the rest of it. And on the guest list was the super cartel, the members of, they were coming in from all over the world, members of the criminal fraternity, everything.
Loads of English, really high-level criminals as well that aren't being named constantly.
Absolutely.
You know?
And Tyson Fury, of course, and everybody from that world. And in the run-up to that wedding, Daniel Kinahan was arranging the murder of James Magogatley.
Yeah.
A guy from his past, from Dublin, from, you know, his sort of youth that he was friendly with, that he was close to, somebody who had sort of stuck with the Hutch side when that feud happened in 2016. Yeah. And he wasn't only just sort of like sitting back and hoping somebody else would do it. Mm. He was micromanaging that conspiracy to kill Magogatley.
While also suing a local media organization who described it as a gangland wedding or whatever.
Yeah.
So he was also doing
who
that.
Who was he soon?
Well, it wasn't it Love in Dubai.
So
that's simultaneously, yeah. that story went yeah. up and came down, and he ultimately they apologized, I think.
And
for
I mean, at that point, he was probably also, I mean, certainly the organizations near him were had legal.
Yeah.
Like letters anyway, in with all the Irish media. Yeah. But to think of that, I mean, to me, that is, while he was reaching for this stardom that he so desperately wanted, where he was, and there was in at that wedding, there was thrones, one for him and one for her.
Yeah, yeah.
They were to sit on their thrones. This was his, you know, coronation
yeah.
as such. And yet he was drawn back to the past,
yeah.
to Dublin, to yeah. the, you know, to where it all began. He seems to have this tie to Dublin that the father didn't have.
No.
Christy Kinahan Sr. left this country and never looked back.
Yeah.
He never had a grow for family, friends, or the past. He went onwards. He was always able to move through various cultures and to, you know, learn languages. His relationships were always with women of different cultural backgrounds than his own. His current partner is a Turkish, Turkish lady. Yeah, it's just, I find it quite interesting that there's a draw. And ultimately, I'd say for Daniel Kinahan, there's a draw to Oliver Bond.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, that's how he views himself as being somewhere from there. And even in his statement, I think, when he was denying involvement after the Panorama programme, it was very much focused on him being from there, an ordinary, proud Irishman mm-hmm. and all of that. I mean,
the interview with English, James English, was to be broadcast on St. Patrick's Day. Yeah. This was to be a celebration of his Irishness, yeah. of his success and everything.
Yeah.
Like, his father doesn't have that. I mean,
no.
We probably need a psychologist here to examine all this. But
yeah, well, maybe. No, look, I suppose that's how he views himself in that context, isn't it? Like, you know, he's a working class guy come good. And I remember Bob Arum, you know, doing an interview. It was third party. He was relating what Daniel said to him. Obviously, there's no tapes or anything, but he was basically saying that Daniel was saying, I've done things bad in my past, but that's where I came from and I'm growing out of it.
Right.
Do you know? And that's kind of maybe how he
was sort of trying to suggest that he had to claw his way up
exactly.
like everybody else, and which he didn't, of course.
Well, but maybe that's how you justify being the head of a murderous cartel, is that, you know, that you came from this is what you grew up with, and, you know, you're you know, that's the explanation you tell yourself.
Have you been watching Succession?
I haven't watched it. No.
Oh my God.
Have you? Yeah. Is it good?
Yeah. Well, I've just watched the grand finale there.
Yeah.
And it's extraordinary. I'm not going to ruin it for anybody who hasn't seen it, but like in a different way, like obviously it's supposed to be loosely based on the Murdochs and the whole, you know, this media dynasty, this incredibly powerful, sociopathic, really.
Yeah.
Patriarch at the head of this family. A mother who is, I mean, odd to say the least, and disengaged from her any maternal instincts she ever may have had. And then these just screwed up kids, adults who are still the kids, still referred to as the kids.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes in these very rich families, they always call them, I always used to think in the Quinns when they call them the children, the Quinn children.
Yeah.
It's like, come on, they're in their 50s.
Yeah, yeah.
Jesus, be so embarrassed. But yeah, it's just that whole dynamic. You wonder how anybody grows up normal
privilege. He's Daniel Kinahan is a product of his background. And
but he didn't, as a young child, he didn't have that privilege.
No, but he
certainly had poverty probably, and
and he certainly had criminality in his around him while he grew up, and, you know, maybe he did.
And addiction and all those other things.
Yeah.
It wasn't just criminality.
Absolutely, he saw these things, and they were normal things to him. Like any child, what they see is normal. What they grow up around is normal. But, you know, does that explain or excuse anything that you do or don't do in your life as you become an adult?
It was, you know, not that long ago that we wouldn't have even been arsed talking about him because he just seemed to be such a nothing in the whole.
Yeah, I do remember that actually being said things. Back in maybe in around the, you know, after Operation Shovel, people would say in the paper, oh, he's a bit boring, is he, compared with some other guys? He's just what, like, there's nothing to say about him.
He looked boring, didn't he?
He looked, and maybe his character wasn't clear, like, and maybe he'd argue his character is not clear from the media thing. But yeah, look, it's an amazing story. It's just an amazing story. And like, it's not to say that that's not to diminish the people that have suffered along the way, but as a kind of an overarching, from there to there, it is incredible, you know?
Mm-hmm. And more to come, no doubt.
Yeah.
You won't be saying that we won't be talking about this again.
No, but we think we probably will be talking about
and
this.
Would you go to Kish?
I actually tell you, I looked at it and I thought, that sounds actually really, really interesting.
That is so screwed up. Yeah, so like if Kish Tourism came on to here and said to you, listen, we'll give you a freebie, will you write a piece up in the Sunday World, 100%. A travel piece?
Would you go for it? I'd go over there.
Would you sell your soul?
I'd go over there in my Crocs and...
They're in the process of installing these ATM machines on Kish that you can, you know, you can actually get cash from your Bitcoin. How does that work? You put in a
Bitcoin and
codey thing or something.
Well, look, they can't.
And they give you dirhams or something for it. Is that right?
There you go.
Yeah.
None of you, if you've no money in your account, you won't get anything out of it.
So you learn a slight little, tiny little bit new every day, don't you?
You do, because I really have not heard
that. You
say
about journalists, we know a little bit about a lot, but not much
about anything.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think it's a good one, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Clodagh's not going to get a blooper out of that because I came out with it right. So I'm delighted. Anyway, right, well, look, we'll live to chat another day.
Yeah, maybe live from Kish, who knows?
Yeah, who knows, indeed. Okay.
You've been listening to Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. Produced by Ian Mullaney and edited by me, Nicola Tallant. Research assistant is Clodagh Meaney. If you like this show and love true crime, leave us a review. Or why not download the free SundayWorld.com app for lots more stories from Ireland and across the globe.